Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
I grew up singing outside, so I was very familiar with being able to carry a tune out into this open space. And I think it was more kind of singing for my parents. Like that strength of believing in someone goes such a long way. And for me, it stretched around the world.
If you were watching Australian Idol 20 years ago, you'll remember Jess Malboy at just 16 years old. She auditioned barefoot, standing in the red dirt and making music with only her voice, creating one of those moments that TV execs fantasize about and audiences never forget. Jess didn't win Idol, she came second, but she used the exposure and experience to build a legitimate music career and made it last, sharing stages with everyone from Beyoncé to Pitbull, from Jason Derulo to Snoop Dogg. What's it like to be a cute, smart Indigenous kid with rare singing ability who lives a long way from the big smoke? And if you took that cute, smart Indigenous kid, jetted her away from her family and homelands and thrust her into the spotlight, made her famous, how would she go? After 2 decades in the spotlight, how has she managed to stay grounded and kind and joyful? Now in her 30s, Jess has recently become a mum and is taking greater control of her life and her music on her own terms. I'm Yumi Steins, and ladies, we need to talk to Jess Malboy about the women who made her and the woman she's become.
I was always on the ocean, on the water, in the channels of the Darwin Rivers. We would drive to Buffalo Creek and land the little dinghy, the tin boat. He would weave through the mangroves.
Some of Jess's core childhood memories are of fishing for barramundi and mud crabs for dinner with her father. Jess and her four sisters were raised by their Aboriginal mum and Indonesian dad. Food, like her mum's goose curry, was one of the languages they all understood.
Just the waft of the garlic and the ginger and the tamarind filtering throughout the kitchen, through the hallways, up the stairs, into our bedrooms. You knew it was just going to fill you up. It was just like one of those meals that could last a whole week for us kids. All girls, you know, I can just imagine like the hormones like of every like individual body in that house. And, you know, it was just full of love, like that food was love, felt safe.
It's a big part of your story, I think, Jess, is how much your parents and your family did fill your cup and give you confidence. But I just love that idea of all the hormones as well. It's
instantly. Oh my God.
Right. But tell me about growing up among all that female energy.
Oh my gosh. It was a lot. In the line of my sisters, I am the second youngest. There were only 3 bedrooms, like 7 people living in the house. I mean, it was just full of like laughter, full of stories. We all would, you know, bunk in one bed sometimes to tell scary stories. And even though we didn't want to, our older sisters like demanded that we listened. So there was a lot of demand. There was a lot of do this for me, do that for me. And you can use some of my makeup or you know, use my hairspray, you know.
The family home was known as the loudest house on the street, with Jess and her sisters constantly singing and laughing and fighting.
We were so loving, but very, very kind of catty. We knew as the younger siblings to not mess with the older siblings. My parents would always say, when we're not around anymore, you only have each other. So, you know, look after each other, love each other, and it'll come back in life or down the line, it'll come back even more like amazing, you know, like I just got to be patient and be kind. Like they were my best friends and they chose me and I got to choose them.
Like many who grow up in a big family, Jess had to learn tolerance, forgiveness, and compromise. Alongside those values, Jess's mother instilled a deep connection to culture.
She's from two beautiful tribes, so born and raised in Mount Isa in North Queensland, but comes from two beautiful tribes, Cook and Yalanji, Cooktown, and then Wakaman country as well. So we've still got a lot of family up far North Queensland and a lot that we're still uncovering and searching for through Stolen Generation as well on my mother's side. But that still is so strong, and particularly when mum moved when she was about 10 years old with her sisters, when her parents passed on, you know, she found love and safeness in Darwin for the rest of her journey on Larrakia country.
You're also cross-cultural in that you've got Indonesian culture as well. Tell me how those two cultures coexist for you.
Oh, both existed with a really, I guess, full balance within the house. You know, mum obviously not knowing or speaking the language, but just stories from her parents to all of her nanas, her uncles and aunties, and then cousins. We were just always surrounded by that. On dad's side too, was very much like that. For dad, it was about religion. It was about going to church and also just working hard, you know, working around the house and the land. And I guess to kind of show us the importance of family too.
Jess Malboy's home was a meeting place for family members from a big interconnected family tree where they could come and feel connected. Music was a big part of life, and often everyone would end up singing in the backyard.
Dad was always had the guitar or the electric guitar, and he would sometimes sit there and he would, you know, strum chords, singing one of his songs that he grew up as a child in Kupang in Indonesia. And, you know, we'd be listening and then we'd try and harmonize with him. And he loved that. That was so precious to him when we would sit around after he'd just climbed the coconut tree and cut a coconut down for us to share. And then he'd pick up the guitar and he would sing and he would unite us with those things, whether it was food or story or singing, singing songs.
But it was more than just food and singing that kept Jess going. Her parents' faith in her talent and the importance of her heritage gave her something like a two-pronged superpower.
I felt like I was just always dreaming big and then also just thinking about the past and people who'd come before me. I think for my parents, I mean, it wasn't easy, but I think instilling those things, it was like being connected and knowing how to do things on land, but also bring others together from that, because all those things helped us navigate as young women and understand, I think, where we were going to be and what kind of people we were growing into. I feel like I get emotional just thinking about like all the things that they had created in terms of a pathway for us to kind of exist and still remain hopeful and believe, you know.
There's so much in what you just said, Jess, about believing you could be anything and anchoring back to your ancestors and your land and finding power through that. It all points to a moment in your past that's so famous. And I know I'm treading old ground here, but we were both kind of there in a way, which was your audition for Australian Idol when you were barefoot.
Yeah, look, you know, it wasn't really kind of planned and I wasn't really necessarily thinking about how I was going to deliver the song, but it was just, you know, my bearings. I was like, oh, I'm outside. Like, I know this space. Like, I grew up singing outside. I was very familiar with being able to carry a tune out into this open space. And I feel like that was kind of what made me feel grounded and ready. And when I did it, it felt just really easy. I knew the songs. I think it was more kind of singing for my parents who'd, you know, found money to get me there to do this audition. Like that strength of believing in someone goes such a long way. And for me, it was like its arms were really hugging me going, yeah, this is, you're meant to be here, but you don't need to worry.
Wow. I'm going to cry. And then then we're not going to be able to talk because I'll be too busy crying. But that's so, it's so beautiful. And I can picture it so well because sometimes you do need people to believe in you, but it doesn't have to be everybody. It can be just a few important people that send you off and launch you. So that was the start of your career of Jess Malboy, the public figure. I wonder what were the hard parts, Jess? Like, obviously becoming famous at 16 must have been super tricky, moving away from Darwin, leaving home. How did you survive all of that?
It was really hard. There were a lot of moments that overwhelmed me, but I think really and honestly was after the show when there was no cameras anymore, when there was no big lights, when there was no big stage anymore. I remember going back to school and there was one moment where one of the girls came up and she was like, oh, you think you're good now because you're famous. And it shook me. I knew in the back of my mind that there was going to be that, but I didn't think it was going to hit that full on. Mm. But I looked her in the eyes and I said, what makes you think that I think that? I don't think that I am that. And I remember her kind of like pulling up and going, oh, I wasn't ready for her to come back at me, you know, because I think everyone saw me as really quiet Jess at school. Mm. I never rubbed anyone the wrong way.
Jess was still a normal kid when she got back to school and often had to explain that she wasn't rolling in cash or fame. Well, not just yet anyway.
I just felt like I needed to defend myself. And I think if my parents or, you know, the sisters didn't instill, you know, backbone in me, I would have turned my back and started running away.
But Jess didn't run away. She calmly stood her ground and continued to be both a saltwater kid and a pop star because why not both? After school, she was ready to make music for Australia. It meant commercial radio play, record deals, movies, and Eurovision. And despite travelling around the world and recording in major cities, she always came home to Darwin to reset. In her late 20s, back home and over tea with her mum, Teresa, she learnt about the grandmother she'd never met, Nanny Hilda. Jess thinks of her as the original diva.
She was always very beautiful, beautiful chocolate skin, always wore red lipstick. She was someone who enjoyed music and dancing and created a really beautiful, loving family. I've found a sense of her personality and hearing stories about her and through images that I also too wanted to be that. Just confidence and knowing
and owning the room a bit, but you didn't have an active relationship with her because she died when your mum was just 10.
Yeah, so Nanny Hilda passed away. I think she was 37. Mm. Actually, I'm 37. Ooh. So when I think about that and think of her and I see her, and I just say kind of thank you, you know, because without you, I wouldn't have the mum that I have today, and also the stories that have been passed on about you and who mum is, and that strength and that sense of pride, which is so powerful.
Jess was so inspired by Nanny Hilda, she made a whole album in 2019 named after her and dedicated it to both Hilda and her mum, Teresa, for guiding Jess into womanhood.
When I was creating the record Hilda, I wanted all those things. I wanted to have my mother's spirit in there, and my cousin sisters and my titty girls, my sisters, all these women that have held us up. I wanted them to feel like they were all of these songs. So yeah, it was all the things that I had heard about Nana, heard about Hilda, I wanted to kind of keep that alive, you know, and also acknowledge that that also is within me.
Hilda was the start of Jess fully focusing on telling her own stories. She co-wrote every track on the album, something that she didn't really get to do much of when she was younger.
I think when I started off, I was like, oh yeah, I can sing. But now my goal and the important goal is to be able to write. Now, how do I be recognized for that? When I look back at my younger self, I didn't even know me yet. I had to learn really fast, but at the same time, be very kind to myself because I was still learning and picking up tools when it came to music. And I think that that writing allowed me to have that confidence and being able to show up and have something to say, or at least have a knowing. I knew I could sing, but I needed to really feel like from my own story and where that came from.
Jess also found creative freedom by starting her own record label, Jamali Records. It was the end of the era of being a compliant, people-pleasing product of the music industry. I like to think of it as switching on your boss lady mode.
Oh, that's what it feels like. Like I could actually just exhale, and I kind of felt relieved because I didn't think, and that imposter syndrome was always beaten down at me all the time. But I needed to kind of acknowledge that, going, I got the reins now. I can take this.
Boss lady mode unlocked. Now Jess was using her decades of experience to mould and shape her career and creative output. A song she'd co-written called Yours Forever was just out, exalting the beauty of reciprocated love. She was on tour playing massive shows, the song was a hit, and life was, well, excellent.
It was falling into line, and 2024 was like my happiest, and also shocking because I found out I was also pregnant. So it was two things of, oh, wow, what, it's now just happening. Being acknowledged, being really respected in music, being kind of like unapologetic about it too, because I just wanted everyone to work together and I was that kind of peacemaker. But now I didn't have to feel like that.
Was there a conflict between your pursuit of great music and trying to be a parent?
So much. I think it was just scary because I just, when the news kind of happened, I was halfway touring and I knew that I was because I'd just come off doing the 2-hour show and my hands were sweaty and I was on all fours. Like I was literally huffing and puffing. And I was like, I feel weird. Like I feel really dizzy. Like I'd done a 2-hour show, like high intensity without stopping, without any breaks. And I've done this before, but why am I like, is it my menstrual cycle?
Yeah. Hormones.
And yeah. And my hormones. And yeah, it was nuts. I think a week later I'd done a test and I was so afraid to tell anyone. And even my own team, I remember I was like, everything's planned. Like, what are we going to do? I don't want to disappoint anyone. That started to creep in. And obviously, the first person I told was my partner. And he was so over the moon. My partner and I, Them and I, have been together for like 20 plus years. And I always knew he wanted to be a dad. He always knew that I wanted to be a mom. And it was just, you know, when? We always kept asking each other, like, when is the right time?
But as Jess found out, the best time to have a baby is when you're pregnant with a baby. Unlike so many people in the public eye, especially the young, cute, and photogenic, Jess and her husband were never tempted to sell pictures of their wedding. They lived privately and kept the pregnancy a secret.
I was also determined to like work through as well, and not crazy, but I still wanted to try and be able to balance and have that experience for myself. Because I'd heard so many stories. Like I was reaching out to people, how are you doing it? Like, are you still working? Like, when did you stop working? And so I think with a lot of that knowledge and a lot of that open conversations that I was having behind doors, like, it really helped, you know, bring a sense of like, I can do this. I really wanted to be my selfish self and just like really privately experience what I was going through. And I'm really proud and glad that I was able to keep that for me, just so I could go through the fields and without taking anybody else's on.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing I could really control at the time. And I'm so happy. Like it has, I remember when I was singing pregnant, it really, I had to sing from a different place.
Yeah. There's less room in there.
I had to find another gut. I was like, can I use somebody else's gut? Because there is no room.
That's so good. So we've talked about your mum, we've talked about your sisters, your grandma Hilda. How have those women influenced how you'll be a mum?
Oh, in so many ways. I think when I think about Nanny, when I think about Nanny Hilda, I think about how her time wasn't enough, you know, for herself. And I often think, oh my gosh, I'm going to get emotional. Yeah, I think about that she didn't get the time with her beautiful kids who've turned out so amazing, who've been like my own mum, you know, like Auntie Raylene, Auntie Rhonda, Auntie Cheryl, they are my mums as well.
Backed by a millennia of ancestors, the women in Jess's life have funneled their power and fierceness into a woman who understands that power can be female.
Women who had to fight and find solace somewhere and create that strength and create that motherness whilst thinking about their mum who's passed on and never got the chance to have any of those firsts. Now becoming a mum, or am now a mum, yeah, I just always want to hold space for other women and other mothers or other people who have defined that. For Mia, I want to be, I want to trust her, you know, as my parents trusted me. They instilled so much trust that I went out into the world so young, and I was determined to put my voice in all these different spaces. And that's why I want to continue to be and feel that, she, you know, she can, that feeling of being on top of the world, you know, for her.
And Jess, can you see how the inspiration that you might give your daughter also translates to the way that your work feeds other young girls and young women?
Yeah. Oh, yes, so much. You know, I feel like that's how I've always been with my music, as so much as to give my vulnerability, like who I am and where I'm from, and like just that bit of grit, you know, that little bit of tongue in cheek. If I can give that within the song and the music, and that can be felt, that's the most important. And for someone to go away and look in the mirror or be in their car, be on the treadmill, you know, have their ear pods in, or, you know, however you're listening to music, that's what keeps me happy and keeps me going and keeps me wanting to be in this space, because I feel like that's my responsibility as an artist. Every time I get into the studio, that is my goal, is when I sit there and I'm going through all those feels, I'm wishing and hoping that that is going to be felt by somebody else with their own experience.
It's so funny because you describe somebody maybe listening on the treadmill with the earpods in, and it's light years away from your childhood. Dad's up the tree, you're in the backyard, there's an acoustic guitar. There's nothing plugged in. There's no screens. I'm curious about Mia and her experience of childhood. I know she's just little at the moment, but have you brought her back to Darwin?
I have many times. She's such a little traveler already. She's done already more, we're laughing because she's done more flights than them, her father. And we got a really good gut laugh out of that.
Will she be a saltwater kid too?
I hope that for her. I'm wanting to have for her, you know, that connection to where I grew up, you know, feeling a sense of freedom and to experience, you know, the smell of waking up in Darwin, to like, you know, knowing when it's going to rain because you can smell the rain before it even hits. And she, like, already, like, the amount of times we've gone back, she kind of sits there in the backyard, like, beside the pool, and you can see her kind of really feeling the heat. And I remember that as a kid. I have these fond memories of us just, you know, after, like, a 10-minute play, we'd be there, like, huffing and puffing and, like, just sweat dripping from us. And, you know, Mum's like, you kids, don't come in here. Because he'll be wanting to go inside to get a bit of water. And she's like, I'll bring the water out. You kids are not coming inside. And I see that. I see that already with her running around and running in this monsoon rain and taking her out on Dad's little tin boat and, you know, taking her out for a fish and her catching her first crab or first barra. Wow.
Mm. Has she tried the goose curry?
She has. It was a bit spicy at the time, but she loved the potatoes because Mum puts potatoes, and it was a different taste. The goose was a bit tough. Yeah, it was beautiful to watch because they're all things that I'm still yet to, you know, experience with her as she grows and she continues to grow and to who she is.
Well, congratulations on everything, on especially becoming a mum.
Thank you.
And the beautiful relationships that you've maintained throughout your career, your long and successful career, Jess Malboy. So good to talk to you.
Lovely to see you.
Take care.
Love you, Sissy. Have a good day. Ta-ra. Bye.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gadigal, Muwinina and Dharawal people. Ladies We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. It's produced by Elsa Silberstein and Sarah Mashman. Our supervising producer is Emma Morris and our executive producer is Tamar Kranswick. This series was created by Claudine Ryan.